You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 30th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House in London with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, it's been one of the most talked about exhibitions of the year here in London, so today we'll be asking whether David Bowie is, at the Victoria and Albert Museum, lives up to the hype, with author and journalist Chris Roberts.
For today's music review, we'll be enjoying a bit of this.
Tell me which day. Freedom Day. Well, I don't know.
It's a reggae special this Easter weekend with the men behind Trojan Sound System.
And we'll be welcoming back literary agent Claire Conville to talk us through some of her favourite new writing.
Plus, cultural highlights from New York and elsewhere. So lots to look forward to, as ever, this week on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House for today's instalment of The Review with me, Andrew Muller and Gillian DeBias. Gillian, have you done anything cultural this week? Because I haven't,
well,
I confess.
I have, but before I talk about what I've done, where are my Easter eggs? I was expecting a little Easter egg hunt around the studio. You haven't been hiding my Easter eggs.
There's not many places, there's not really many, such is the sort of tasteful minimalism of our studio, inevitably, that there wouldn't be many places to hide anything.
I'm disappointed, but anyway, but I did...
Possibly in the desk, but they'd melt.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe the control room have some for me. But anyway, what I'm trying to do now is I find that you can get a bit stuck in a groove and you tend to go to the same exhibitions and the same museums and the same galleries. So I'm trying to discipline myself to go to every week a different gallery around London. So I've been meaning to go. There's a small design gallery in Soho called 19 Greek Street, and it opened during the London
Design. What's the address?
So it opened during the London Design Festival, and what I find interesting, it's one of what was probably an old CD film company. Now that the film business is sadly moving out of Soho, and they've just repainted it all white, and every floor is a different design company or a different design country. And so, you know, in the first floor, they have a design from Brazil, and they just opened on the third floor, a design from the Middle East. And it's a lovely way to discover design by just climbing upstairs, almost like a Dickensian house. And they had some really, really interesting, very small sort of curated contemporary designers from Tel Aviv displayed there.
Is this a permanent exhibition or a temporary thing?
No, it's temporary. This one just goes till May, but that's a nice thing because it's the kind of thing, it's not a huge gallery, but you can literally just dip in and, you know, a couple of months later, you see what else they have on there. And what I liked about this one is, you dip in, it's small enough, then you go, you walk along Wardour Street or along Fifth Street, and there's so many new cafes opening up, funny little one-of-a-kind stores, and it really shows how you know, Soho, which has been stuck in a rut for a while and got a bit CD, is getting a bit of a facelift.
So that's the 19 Greek Street Museum, which is at 19 Greek Street, presumably, unless they're doing that wacky artsy thing of just putting the wrong address on it.
No, but you know what? I couldn't find it. Yeah, go figure.
Okay. Have they not put a big sign out the front?
Not big enough for me.
Okay. Well, they need to put a bigger sign out. But 19 Greek Street, and that is until when?
That is until May 17th.
Okay. Until May 17th. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this. And this, in that case, wasn't a very long time now, was it? It is perhaps never an entirely happy day when rock and roll gets interred behind a glass case. But if any single artist of the modern era deserves the exhibition-scale reverence of an institution like the Victoria and Albert Museum, it is surely David Bowie, who released his first new album for a decade in January. The reaction to his re-emergence was telling, though The Next Day is a fine album on its own merits. It was overwhelmed by an outpouring of fond nostalgia for a time when a rock and roll singer could accurately be said to matter.
And Bowie mattered like few others before or since. It is difficult to think of an area of modern music entirely unreached by his influence. Now, the V&A exhibition, which is called David Bowie Is, assembles Bowie's costumes, instruments, artwork, and an astonishing collection of personal ephemera. So joining us to tell us what he made of the exhibition is the music journalist and noted Bowiephile, David Roberts. Chris Roberts. You might as well change your name.
Chameleon-like identity.
That's exactly.
Method acting.
Or would you prefer Ziggy?
Let's go with that. Okay. May as well.
Ziggy Roberts joining us now. You've seen the exhibition, obviously. You're a huge Bowie fan, and indeed lifelong Bowie fan, I think it's probably fair enough.
Absolutely,
to say.
Yeah.
Is there an element of mixed feelings about seeing him formally consecrated as a museum piece?
Yes, it's an ageing process, obviously. I think to everybody who grew up in the 70s, who perhaps felt too young for the 60s and wanted to kick out at mum and dad's music, which was, the Beatles or whatever, Bowie was the light and the way. And now to realise that is in museums. Ziggy Stardust costume is in a museum, and all these Bowie artefacts are, as you say, behind glass. It is a sign that, pop culture is in another era. But as pop culture goes, this is as good an exhibition as you could get of those years. It spans out from Bowie into film, music, literature, art, and you therefore get all kinds of rushes of Proust, Proustian rushes of memory from the 70s, 80s, 90s, the good parts and the bad parts. And most of the good parts were in the 70s, most of the bad parts were in the 80s.
It's interesting. So Andrew and I are at a bit of a disadvantage because we couldn't actually get any press tickets. It's so popular, not just with the public, but they're literally rationing how many press can get in. I mean,
I think
is this just hype?
Actually, no, nobody but me has been to see this.
when he broke that decade-long silence in January and returned with the single "Where Are We Now" from Out of Nowhere, followed by the album the next day, you wrote on the excellent website The Quietus of Picasso resurrected in a Rolf Harris era. I mean, what do you think it says of the current state of rock and roll that a 66-year-old who nobody's heard of from a decade can just return and suddenly command centre stage again?
Yeah, I think that's part of the thing is that he did disappear for 10 years, and therefore the impact is, it's the best comeback since his last one. it's a sign that there isn't that much charisma and personality in current pop stars. It's all very anodyne, it's all very corporate. I think, I'm not the first person to say this isn't a revelation. But I think to not just my generation, but a younger one as well, because Bowie did impact on, through the 80s with Ashes to Ashes, Boys Keep Swinging, etc. There's a nostalgia, and there's also a welcome sort of relief that someone interesting is back. Someone you can discuss whether you like this aspect, you don't like this other aspect. It's closer to art. It has intelligence in it, and it isn't devoid of those qualities.
Who would have thought Bowie was such a hoarder? Like, it sounds as if he, from costumes to notebooks to sets, but what interests me are the lyrics, and I gather they're literally handwritten pages of the lyrics. I mean, for you as a Bowie file, what was that like to see songs?
The Grail. Just to see, if you change something in 5 years from I never thought I'd see so many people to I never thought I'd need so many people. And that was the first track on Ziggy Stardust, the first track most of us heard in the early 70s as 12-year-olds or whatever. And it's just, even little deft touches like that are incredibly interesting if you are a fan. In the same way that to a Picasso fan, if they went to a Picasso exhibition, you saw something, a notebook or a diary, that would be fascinating. For me, there's been almost too much attention paid to the costumes. That's every kind of article or piece you see about it, it's going on about the costumes, which are great, but I'm not a fashionista. So I find those just, I went past those in 5 seconds. But when you see, as you say, the notebooks, the set designs, he drew little kind of storyboards for videos and so on. Those things really give you an insight into his way of thinking. Clearly a workaholic, clearly a control freak. Those are good things.
But that's always interesting when you see those rough drafts of stuff that has just become part of the furniture. It reminds you that an album like Ziggy Stardust was not an inevitability. It might have been very different if any one of 1,000 different decisions had been made.
Yeah, in fact, there are some god-awful working titles for the songs on that album. don't spring to mind now, but there's a piece of notepaper with, working possible titles for next album and songs on them, and it would not be as legendary if that had been the case. Through a confluence of serendipitous events, that came to be the one that broke him big. I also kind of think Ziggy, everyone talks about Ziggy again. For me, it's one of his best maybe 8 albums, it's not his best. I think he did better work later. But it's become the kind of the emblem, you know, the go-to, you know, touchstone for Bowie imagery.
You've interviewed Bowie on four occasions, I think I'm right in saying, at various points. What did you get, or what sense did you get of his understanding of his own legacy and his own myth?
He's first of all, he's incredibly charming. You know, he reduces any kind of I'm going to be a strong, tough journalist and ask really difficult questions. That's gone in 2 minutes. And when he comes in, you haven't interviewed him for 3 years, and he goes, "Chris, how's Hammersmith?" And you think he's remembered that I lived in Hammersmith at that time, or he's got a very good PR, obviously, who's told him this guy. He's interviewed you before. He lived in Hammersmith at the time. But I did have to once do a retrospective with him when a new album was out, and had to say, I need to do, you know, going through the albums, album by album. And he kind of went, "Oh, must we? Well, okay, but my memory's like Swiss cheese, got so many holes in it." He was just kind of upfront about that. Once he does get rambling about the past, he does remember things, but it's very difficult to keep him on course, because he likes to go off on tangents. If he's been reading about, say, reading about Russian politics the day before, he will talk about Russian politics for 20 minutes if you don't rein him in. You almost have to clap your hands and say, focus, you know? mean, but there's a great brain in there, there really is. Yeah.
We bill you as a Bowie fan. You must, you know, you've read so much, you must have, you know, studied a lot about him. Was there anything that surprised you or you learnt by going through the rooms at the V&A of this exhibition?
I think as you go through, you kind of go through a lot of smaller areas, and at the very end there's a huge cathedral-like room, which where you get kind of 18-foot high video screens of Bowie performing, which is the degree to which it's neo-religious is you don't even need to point it out. It is kind of bizarre. I saw some film clips there that I hadn't seen before. His performance on Broadway theatre as the Elephant Man, which he did without any prosthetics and did it just with facial tics and movements. I hadn't actually seen much of that, and that was really interesting. And I have to say, objectively, it was very good. And we all know his acting isn't always very good, but this example was.
You did mention or did allude to earlier the bad stuff, and you have to talk about this with Bowie. And I was wondering if you thought that after all this time has become part of his appeal, this fallibility, that enormous, we were discussing earlier, that enormous gap between the best of his best and the worst of his worst, possibly rivaled in music only by Stevie Wonder. Do you think that is actually part of the appeal now, that there is this narrative from this sort of sudden burst of genius in the 70s to the rolled up suit jacket, slap bass wilderness years in the 80s, and then the tentative comebacks and the Tin Machines, and then finally this?
I think so. I think that you develop an affection for any entertainer that you've been a fan of for decades. You know, if there's a hint of vulnerability, a hint of they might screw up at some point, it becomes endearing. Not at the time, you know, when Never Let Me Down album comes out, you're not going, whoop-de-woo, this is amazing. But years on, you kind of look at the path, you look at the trajectory, and you think it hasn't all been machine-like perfection. You know, there's a human being in there with a genius mind, and geniuses are not consistent. You know, there's going to be unfortunate missteps along the way.
The V&A say that at the time they put this exhibition together, they had no idea he was going to release a new album. Can that be true? Do you think Bowie literally had this all sort of planned and it's part of his master plan?
Yeah, that release was as well-kept secret as you're ever going to get, especially in the modern internet age.
It's freakish in this day and age that David Bowie could spend a year making a new record with Tony Visconti and nobody knows.
Yeah, I think Visconti and the musicians were kind of, you know, sworn to secrecy. It was a brilliant masterstroke of publicity, because of course it was so understated and subtle that it made everybody else do all the work and the media did all the running. I don't think the V&A did know about it, because you kind of get a jammed on bit at the end, a tagged on bit about, oh, and now a new album called The Next Day. So I don't think they were aware of it. Otherwise, they clearly would have made more of a, you know, they would have cleared some space by the fire extinguisher.
Where do you think The Next Day does rate in his canon?
I think it's very, very good. It's, I think it's of the same stripe as Heathen and Reality, the most recent two albums, which were both very solid, very good, without perhaps being spectacular. Heathen has some wonderful moments. It is underrated. It's better than those two. It's as good a mature album as you could hope for. The lyrics are very interesting. You know, he's dealing with real issues like mortality. And I think maybe what we used to call side two tails off a bit. It could have done with a couple more ballads. But when it's, you know, 75% of it is excellent. And Given that we were expecting the obituary, this is a lot better than that, you know.
Chris Roberts, author, journalist, Bowie file, thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. And here, inevitably, this is David Bowie from peak imperial pomp. This is Ashes to Ashes.
David Bowie there with Ashes to Ashes. And if you are in London, David Bowie will be on at the Victoria and Albert Museum until the 11th of August. This is The Review on Monocle 24, where next it's time for a cultural journey around the world.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias. Our associate editor, Nelly Gotcheva, has been hard at work again this weekend, searching out some global highlights for the Easter weekend. Here she is to talk us through it.
If in Philadelphia this weekend, check out the International Festival of the Arts, featuring the latest in music, theatre, fashion and photography from around the world. We recommend Everyone and I, a theatre play inspired by the life and music of Billie Holiday. Hosted by the Kimmel Center for Performing Arts, the festival runs until the end of April. In Shanghai, graffiti artists Stan and Lex are exhibiting their works in China for the first time. The Italian duo have collaborated in the streets of Rome since 2001 and quickly rose to fame for their black and white portraits of anonymous people. Housed in Gallery Magda Danis, this special show features some of their most famous large-scale portraits. The exhibition is on until the end of April. For the contemporary design lovers in London, we suggest the exhibition Designing the Middle East. Housed in 19 Greek Street Gallery, the show features for the first time in London the works of Israeli designers Noam Dover and Miko Cederbaum. Designing the Middle East is on until the 17th of May. The 5th Okinawa International Movie Festival closes this weekend after a week of screening films from around the world. For the closing days, we recommend Jury, directed by the founder of the Busan Film Festival, Kim Dong-ho. For more information, go to oimf.jp. And on our playlist this weekend, we have German artist DJ Kotze and his first solo album in 9 years, entitled Amygdala. Expect techno beats and some hip-hop influences. And now let's hear Neis's Völkchen. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That was DJ Kotze there, ending that report by Nelly Gotcheva. And so to our weekly music review. And because it's Easter, we have not one but two guests reviewers this week.
Daddy Ad and Earl Gateshead are better known as Trojan Sound System. Formed in 2004, they tour the globe representing the seminal UK reggae record label Trojan, playing a mix of ska, reggae, dub, dancehall and other heavily bass-laden music to fans everywhere, as well as working on their own productions.
They join us in studio fairly fresh from a gig in Geneva. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know about fresh, actually. But
yeah. Are your ears still ringing from your Geneva gig?
We're still groggy, that's for sure, yeah.
So what were you doing in Geneva?
We were doing the Electron Festival, which is a really stylish festival they have there in Geneva. A lot of really good electronic music people. And they do a full selection, so they have reggae too.
The question about whether your ears are ringing, the question I wanted to ask was like whether your ears are perpetually ringing. I think maybe if you could explain the importance of the sound system to what you do, that enormous bass-heavy noise.
Yeah, it is a different way to listen to music. It's a unique way to listen to music. It's because in a proper sound system, the thing goes through a preamplifier, which changes the nature of the sound, basically, and makes it individual, the circuitry and the preamplifier. And then it goes to the signal, is then split into three, which was never... Sound systems invented splitting the signal into three, bass, middle and top, the three separate frequencies, and then sending each, say, the bass frequencies only to the bass speakers. That was the Jamaican contribution to hi-fi listening.
And how important is the size of the speakers?
Well, weight, I mean, Ad'll tell you, Ad's the expert, but weight obviously helps the bass resonate, probably. Yeah. Ad, would you like to speak?
Size does matter.
Yeah. And weight does matter as well, because, it's quite a scientific thing, but frequencies are generated by the air inside the speaker, pushing in and out, the actual air moves.
So you can almost feel it. That's
exactly.
The beauty of it.
Music is a physical. It's a physical thing.
Is that the importance of the volume, though? Even if it occasionally, or indeed often, overwhelms the actual music, the physicality of the volume.
It's to a degree. I mean, we try to take a sort of audiophile approach to the way that we, in terms of what we put into the system. So we use high-end cartridges, make sure the turntables are set up properly, which is a dying art, to be honest with you. And it makes a phenomenal amount of difference. And when you set something up correctly, there's a lot less distortion in the signal path. Yeah. So you don't need to be that loud if the sound is pure.
Do you still exclusively use vinyl records? And
we do, yeah.
Yeah, analog from the start of the chain to the end of the chain. It doesn't go into digital anywhere.
How much of a difference do you think that makes to the sound? I mean, as you say, it's a dying art because people much prefer just the convenience of not even CDs anymore. I think it's become that appeal of, like, why lug around crates and crates and crates of vinyl records when you can have 40,000 songs in your pocket?
But I think convenience definitely comes at a price. And it's all well and good not carrying around, lugging around big bags of records, but the sound and the feeling and the atmosphere is affected.
Is the difference really that note? Is it the sort of thing that only professionals would notice?
No, or anybody could notice. And if you don't notice it consciously, you notice it subconsciously. Even the rankest amateur would subconsciously feel the difference. They wouldn't. They would just think the music doesn't sound as nice. They wouldn't think, oh my God, that's digital. But the reality is, and it's because it's digital that they don't like the music as much.
And MP3s are, 10% of the quality of vinyl? The same information's in there in terms of the rhythm and the lyrics and the melody, but the emotion's kind of sucked out of it when it's compressed that much.
The magic.
Yeah.
Well, you've picked three tracks for us to listen to today, which I wish we could play on vinyl, but we won't be doing that. The first one, I guess, it's fairly old school. This is Ken Booth with Freedom Day. If you could just remind us who Ken Booth was, and then we'll play some of that.
Well, Ken Booth's an early Jamaican singer. He's still singing now, but he's one of the first Jamaican. He came through in the rocksteady era, which was just followed ska. The ska era led to the rocksteady era, led to the reggae era. This is one of his from the rocksteady to reggae era. In my opinion, he's one of the best Jamaican singers that Jamaica's ever produced, maybe even the best. He's got a soulful edge, like a lot of people who came. Rocksteady basically was a Jamaican approximation of soul music. Soul music was massive in America in the mid-60s, the Otis Redding type soul music.
Okay, well, this is Ken Booth with Freedom Day.
Friends, brethren, people, every day you hear one talking about.
So tell me which day is gonna be a peaceful day.
Ken Booth with Freedom Day, the first of today's selections from our guest music reviewers, Trojan Sound System. The next one you've picked for us, I guess, is a bit of an intersection of the new and the old.
Yeah, this is, I love this track. We both love this track because it does intersect new and old. Josh Shaka, who's one of the original London Sound System operators, had a special. I don't know if you know what I mean, a track that he produced only for him to play in the 80s called Jehovia. And whenever this was played at an 80s dance, when Josh Shaka was really the voice of Black London completely, the voice of Caribbean Black London for sure, his dancers were rammed. And whenever this track was played, the place would go absolutely crazy. It's got a melody line in it. And Rusko has taken that melody line and adapted it slightly and mixed it up with another great reggae tune from the 80s called Jehovia. And he's made a dubstep tune out of it, a brand new dubstep tune, which carries the same spirit. I'll tell you, when we play it, with our vocalists on, we get a fantastic reception, and I'm sure it's the cultural background does help, the background in the reggae culture, even though it sounds so new.
It does, and I guess one of our missions as well is, so reggae has influenced so many different forms of contemporary dance music, from obvious things like drum and bass, dubstep, house production as well, that sort of psychedelic dubbed out way of approaching production. And we really enjoy trying to let people know who are into these forms of music kind of where it comes from or came from, and trying to build bridges, I guess, between those cultures.
Okay, well, let's hear a bit of this. This is Rusko's version of Jehovah. That was Rusko's version of Jehovah, the second choice of today's guest music reviewers, Earl and Adam from Trojan Sound System. We're going to play one of your own works shortly, but before we get to that, what are you up to at the moment? Having just come back from Geneva, what are your immediate plans?
Dinner.
Wind it a bit further forward, if you would.
That's a long way to think. Yeah, that's fast forward. We are working on a new EP. Which is leading up to the next album that we want to release later this year. We finished this particular track literally last week, so it's not mastered yet, but it's mixed. And we're really quite excited about it. We've been road testing out of the different gigs we've been doing, and literally people have been dancing from the first bar, haven't they? Even singing along, actually. We were cutting out the music the other night, and the whole room was singing this kind of chorus line that you'll hear in the track.
That's a good sign when they're singing along to a record that isn't out yet.
Yeah,
exactly. Or it means it's an incredibly bad sign because it means they've already found it and stolen it and bootlegged it.
That's more likely.
Where are some of your best audiences? I mean, London's always had a love affair with reggae. Is this still one of the best places to play, or are there
other
countries?
It's a nice place to play, but we really love Rome, for sure. The Romans love their reggae.
Yeah, Italy is a crazy one for reggae. Yeah. My experience of club culture out there was more on the dance music side, and it was, like Italy, it's kind of in two halves, really. There's the very glamorous, bright lights, lots of mirrors, so you can see yourself dancing and stuff on the dance music side. And then there's the left side of Italy, and there's a massive, massive reggae scene there. They used to have a festival there called Rototom that we played a few years ago, which has now been moved to Spain, and that was like 90,000 people for a week.
And when it comes to the new stars of reggae, is this still really coming out of Jamaica, or are there other urban centres that are...
Well, it goes up and down in Jamaica. They went into Bashment for a long time, maybe 5 years, and Bashment wasn't... They were speaking to themselves, really. The rest of the world didn't really pick it up. But now they're moving back to the more radical side. There's been a slow turn back away from... Not that I'm knocking Bashment. Bashment's great. But really, only Jamaicans like it. It's never going to reach the world the way Burning Spear and Bob Marley and Black Uhuru did. The more spiritual side of Jamaican music is now on the way back, and performers like Conscience are moving it back again. So, which is something that we never left. So we're happy to see Jamaica turn back, because without the engine of Jamaica to produce ideas and spirit, reggae music suffers, and we love reggae music. We don't want it to suffer.
With that, Earl Gateshead and Daddy Ad from Trojan Sound System, thank you for joining us as our guest music reviewers today on The Review. We will play you out with one of your own works. This is The Bomb.
Thank you.
Was The Bomb by Trojan Sound System. Daddy Ad and Earl Gateshead therefrom were this week's musical guests here on The Review. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Time now to cross over to New York to hear Barrett Austin's tips on what to do there over the Easter.
This weekend marks the opening of Room 237, a new documentary by Rodney Asher, which offers a close examination of Stanley Kubrick's 1980 psychological horror, The Shining. Viewers are transported back to The Shining's chilling Overlook Hotel in Asher's quest for new meaning in Kubrick's hit film. Like all of Stanley Kubrick's film, The Shining was laced with outside references, and it's these references, from allusions to the Holocaust in an elevator scene to the issue of Native Americans and genocide, these are the ideas Room 237 tries to unpack. Just this week, California-based rock duo Milk Carton Kids released their latest album, entitled The Ash and Clay.
Swing sets are empty, like dirt turned dark of the night.
The easy comparison for the music of L.A. bass Kenneth Pattingale and Joey Ryan, it's to say they sound like Simon and Garfunkel. You'll find this comparison hard to deny, that there's a sense of purity that's apparent through all 12 tracks on The Ash and Clay. Milk Carton Kids are just setting out on a short European tour and will tour the whole of America, setting out from Nashville in just a few weeks.
We're coming home tonight.
If it's a bit of live music you're after, there's no harm in fighting for a ticket to see Brooklyn's Sharon Van Etten, who'll be opening for Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds at the Beacon Theatre on Saturday night. While it's fair to assume that most in attendance are probably there to see Nick Cave, Van Etten's opening act is alone worth the cost of admission.
You're talking too loud, won't you walk over, whisper motion, hands are battle-ash, you gotta see.
Having released her last album in 2012, you can probably expect to hear some of Van Etten's latest work on stage this go-around. And lastly, if there's any time to spend beating around Chelsea over the weekend, Thomas Wolfe's latest exhibition at David Zwerner Gallery is well worth a visit. Having just opened on Thursday, the show features Wolfe's latest series entitled Photograms. The focus on abstract shapes and line references the artistic experimentation of cameraless photography that was prevalent in the early 20th century. That's at Zwerner's Gallery on West 19th Street, right in the heart of Chelsea. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Barrett Austin.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We will be back after this to get our teeth sunk into some new literature.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're at 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And a guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And welcome back. It's Saturday and you are listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Andrew Muller.
And to finish today's show, we'll be talking literature, and we're delighted to welcome back to The Review literary agent Claire Conville. Claire is the co-founder of Conville & Walsh, who represent dozens of authors, including the satirist Charlie Brooker, historian Misha Glennie, the humorist Marcus Berkman, and the songwriter Luke Haynes. Claire, welcome back to The Review. You've bought a bunch of books there in your bag. What was the first one you wanted to open?
Well, I wanted to talk about a beautiful book that has come my way called A Tale for the Time Being by a writer called Ruth Ozeki, I think that's how you pronounce it. And her first novel made a big sensation some years ago called My Year of Meat. This is her new novel, and it's, as the title might suggest, about time. But it's the story is told in a very unusual way. We have two kind of central characters in the novel. We have Now, a girl, a young Japanese girl who's living with her family in Japan, experiencing all the sort of highs and lows of adolescence. But what we do begin to gather through other sources that this is pre-tsunami Japan. And then we move to Ruth, who's living sort of on the Alaskan coast with her husband Oliver in a kind of strange kind of wilderness. The nearest town is known as Whale Town. And these two connect, and they connect because Ruth finds washed up on the shore, wrapped very carefully in plastic, Now's diary. And her diary of her time in Japan. And her husband, Ruth's husband, who's obviously a kind of ecologist, says it must have come. It must have been washed ashore on the back of the tsunami.
Now, I gather it's like she finds this Hello Kitty diary. And also, I haven't read it, but what I've been reading about it is that it's sort of bound in the cover, this diary, of La Recherche du Temps Perdu. Is this an homage to Proust?
Well, yes, in as much as it's about time, it's about time. It's not really time travel, but of course it is time travel. I mean, I think the inspiration is probably the work of Einstein and quantum mechanics. But of course, she plays with the ideas of time, themes of time. And I think it's a nod rather than an homage to Remembrance of Things Past. But all the way through, time is referenced in different kinds of ways. So, yes, it's her big theme. And in fact, the book opens with Now, the young girl, the young voice in the book saying, we are all time beings as opposed to humans. We are all beings kind of travelling through time, wafting through time, experiencing time in different ways. So I'm no longer human, I'm a time being.
To what extent is she playing with ideas about place as well as time? Because the idea of finding a diary washed up from tsunami-stricken Japan on the other side of the Pacific Ocean is an obvious enough, I guess, metaphor for an increasingly connected world in which we all know what's happening everywhere all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, it's a very good question. I'm sure that is it. I'm sure that is part of the story. I think what I feel she's really saying, or the idea she's really focusing on, is a principle of quantum mechanics, which is entanglement, which is how very small pieces of matter from different parts of the world can connect and create something else. So, yes, she's writing about our interconnectivity, but I think she's also saying that a voice of a young Japanese girl can touch the lives of a sort of slightly disappointed middle-aged woman living in a totally different world and a totally different culture. And they can connect in the most unlikely of ways. So I suppose, yes, it's a kind of, it's kind of quite an existential idea, I think.
You say existential. I mean, it seems there's so many layers here. Does it work, or is it a bit self-conscious? Is it an easy
No,
read?
I thought it was, I literally picked it up and started reading it a couple of weeks ago, and then like 3 hours later, suddenly thought, God, that, you know, that the time flew by, dare I say it. But I absolutely loved it. I thought it was totally unpretentious, accessible. You have the yearning, sort of quasi-cynical, quasi-innocent voice of Now on the one hand, and then you have Ruth sort of struggling with the sort of issues of middle age and a sort of long-term marriage, her inability to write the book she wants to write, her own sense of isolation in a totally different place.
That's Ruth Ozeki's tale for the time being. What else have you bought us?
Well, I bought a book called Secrecy by Rupert Thompson, and I'm sure that any number of your listeners will know about Rupert Thompson's work. He's written, I think, some 10 books. I think I've read 8 out of the 10. And he wrote a wonderful memoir called This Party's Got to Stop, about his own rather unusual childhood growing up in Eastbourne. He's also a very good friend of mine, so it's been very interesting to, and I've known him for nearly 25 years, so it's very interesting to watch him develop as a writer. Secrecy is set in Florence in the late 17th century. So gone are the days of the great Renaissance and the power of the Medicis. And instead, you've got rather a sort of brutal, repressive, secretive regime. Fornicators and sodomites are decapitated and stuck on the sort of castle walls. And the sort of particularly sort of delicate but rather brutal descriptions of sort of crows with sort of eyeballs hanging out of their beaks and things like that. But it's about, based on a real man, an artist called Zumbo, who created these extraordinary tableaus of sort of the victims of the plague, of disaster, out of wax. And in his day, he was considered a great artist. And he's employed ostensibly by the Duke to come to Florence and create a model of a sort of perfect woman, the ultimate Eve for the sort of Duke's private delectation. But almost immediately he gets drawn into the court life, which is sort of full of intrigue, full of secrets, and finds himself at the web of a very dark thriller indeed, actually.
This is roughly based on a real character. Historical fiction is very popular at the moment. Is this part of a wave, a trend, or is this really quite individual? This book?
Well, I think, obviously Hilary Mantel has sort of, you know, set an incredible marker in the sand on all of this. I think what's wonderful about this book is Rupert's lightness of touch. He wears his research very lightly. It's incredibly accessible. You're immersed in the story. As I say, he writes with great delicacy and sort of acuity about the world he imagines and sees around him. You can feel the sort of walls of the Bagnello. You can sort of sense the kind of secrets and the darkness in the sort of in the sort of alleyways of Florence. But he doesn't, as I say, the writing is deceptively simple and subtle. I think Hilary Mantel is kind of psychic in what she does, but it's very detailed and quite elaborate. Rupert's doing something very different here. There's an airiness about it that then is sort of betrayed by its very dark subject matter. But as I say, another book, you just sit down and you don't really stand up until you've finished it.
What do you think has appealed to him about that setting of 17th century Florence, aside obviously from the opportunity to write about crows pecking out the eyeballs of impaled heads? Which is a good enough reason to write about anything, really.
I think it's an unusual period, because most people, if people are writing about Florence, they tend to write about the sort of 15th and 16th century, when, you know, the sort of extravagant extravagance of the Medici's, the court life, the money, the painters, the power. Here, Florence is in a very different place. It's sort of repressive and unpleasant and has lost its former sort of glory and dignity. So I think the fact that they're no longer sort of glorifying sort of beautiful tableaus and churches or sort of fantastic statues by Michelangelo, instead are sort of fixating on sort of wax images of sort of people dying of bubonic plague, gives you an idea of the sort of creepiness and strangeness of what of Florence has become. And I suspect, knowing Rupert as I do, that that probably attracted him.
I mean, it sounds like a plot with incredible intrigue and layers of storytelling. But I was reading in an interview with Thompson that he said he lets the plot unravel in his subconscious. Like, he's not a man who pins up flowcharts of where the story is going to go. Is that, knowing him as you do, is that true?
Well, I, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Which authors, what craft authors bring to their work. I think Rupert escapes into a very highly realised, imagined world, and I'm sure the plot evolves, as you see, partly out of his subconscious, but he immerses himself in the books that he writes. There's no doubt about that. He disappears for weeks at a time and totally becomes part of what he's writing.
That's Secrecy by Rupert Thompson. What's your third selection?
My third selection is a novel called The Infatuations by Javier Marías. It's a novel in translation from Spanish. Javier Marías is a sort of a figure in Spanish publishing. He's not only a writer, he has his own column in El País, he has his own publishing house. And he's very much from a European tradition of writers, I think. He's the books are sort of fantastically engaging, densely written, experiential. I mean, recognisably not American, not English. The voice is coming from a very different place. And it's a very brilliant and clever novel, I think. It's about a youngish woman who works in a publishing house, who has seen this couple every morning having breakfast and has been sort of very much drawn to them and sort of rather infatuated by them. And then, you know, after many months and years of seeing them every day but never talking to them, she discovers that the husband has been murdered. And she makes herself known to the wife and finds herself drawn into this world that she had idealised so much, to discover that something very different has been going on.
He was saying that ultimately, when asked what is the book about, he too says it's about secrecy. How does that play out?
It is about secrecy, and it's about the lies we tell ourselves, and about the lies people tell to each other, and it's about how different how ostensibly something could look like one thing and then becomes tangibly something else. And I think what's very clever is that the eye of the novel is drawn into this mystery, and it's a murder, it's a thriller again, but it's become a kind of participant without ever realising she was ever going to be one, if that makes any sense. She's an unwilling participant at the end.
And that's Javier Marías, The Infatuations. I believe there's one other book that you wanted to get a quick plug in for.
These books I've read and loved. The book I wanted to talk about very briefly is a book that I represented, and I'm very proud and happy for Piers Tordet. And this is his first novel for children. It's called The Last Wild. And it really is an enchanting story about a little boy called Kester, who it's set in the future, and he's in some sort of strange asylum cum Borstal for boys, and he can't speak. And one night, he's having a miserable time, but one night he's freed by some wild animals. And these are the last wild creatures who are left on Earth. And there's a stag and a wolf cub and a sort of a spoilt cat and a dancing mouse. And he in turn realises he has to help free them too. So it's a very charming story, probably for sort of 8-year-old upwards, and a very good Easter present for anybody who doesn't want to give a child a chocolate egg.
Claire Conville of Conville and Walsh, thank you very much for joining us again on The Review. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. It's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show was produced by Katie Bilboa and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell.
As ever, Robert Bound will be back with a new culture show on Monday at 1900 hours London time. Here's what's in store next week.
On the latest edition, we dress up as the next Harry Potter to attend Bologna's Children's Book Fair, go largely AWOL at a festival in Mexico, and find out why there's a big red shed on London's South Bank.
And starting Monday, you'll be able to listen to the relaunch of Monocle 24 with a brand new schedule, but still full of lots of exciting items and up-to-the-minute news programmes. You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller and Gillian DeBias. Thanks for listening. Have a happy Easter.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.